Welcome to all of you. I'll recite a few Sanskrit prayers invoking blessings for all of us today before officially starting my presentation with your permission. Om Jnana Timirandasya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Militam Jena Tashmi Shri Gurave Namah Namashyashtam Manumati Satchiputram Atra Sharupam Rupam Tasya Vrajamarupurim Matrim Vashtavatim Radha Kondam Girivaram Maho Radhika Madhavasam Praptu Yashya Pratitta Kripaya Shri Gurum Tamnatushmi Vanchakalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyai Vacham Patita nam pavanebhyo vaishnavibhyo namo namah. Nikila shruti mole ratna mala dite Nirajita padapanka janta Haji mukta kulair pashyamanam paritashtam harinam samshrayami Anarpita charim chirat karunaya vatirana kalahum Shamar Paitamana Tochvalarasam Sohakti Sriyam Hari Purata Sundara Dutikadamba Sandipita Sadari Daye Kandaresh Purato Vasachinandana Ajana Lambita Bujo Kanaka Badato Sankirtanai Kapitaro Kamalaya Takshuna Vishwambaro Dvijavaro Jugadharma Palo Vande Jagat Priyakaro Karuna Avataro Ladini Shakti Sarupaya Gauranga Suhridaya Cha Bhakta Shakti Pradanaya Gadadhara Namastute He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dina Bandho Jagatpate Bhupesha Gupika Kanta Radha Kanta Namastute Radhi Vrindavanadishri Karunamrita Vahine Kripaya Nijapadarjadasyan Mahyam Pradiyatam Bhaktya Vihinaya Aparadha Lakshaye Kipta Shakamaditarangamadhi Kripa Maitvam Sharanam Prapanam Brinde Maste Charanaravindam Brinde Maste Charanaravindam Sri Sachinandan Gaurhari Ki Jai Sri Harinam Sankirtan Ki Jai Sri Sri Gaur Nityananda Sri Sri Gaur Gadadhar Ji Ki Jai Sri Sri Radha Madan Mohan Radha Govinda Dev Radha Gopinath Ji Ki Jai Gaur Bhakta Vrinda Ki Jai Gaur Premananda Hari Bol So again, welcome to all of you. Thank you so much for your presence, your time, your company. And we have a very interesting audience today. Very grateful for the invitation by Rupa and Kumariji and Purnima. On the topic that she announced, I'll be talking to all of you. Some of you are very esteemed sannyasis and elders, devotees who have many of you have been born in this particular practice and tradition. Some of you probably visiting us for the first time, second time, third time. So it's a very interesting combination of hearts, so to say. So I will try my best to address the theme that Kumari announced in a way that hopefully is relevant for all of us. But in advance, I beg your patience and forgiveness in case some of the things I say may sound too high for some or too low for others. At least I will say that if in any of these gatherings, if we can just leave the gathering with at least one particular point that touched your heart, and we know there's homework working for us in that regard, then the meeting was a success. In other words, don't come to these meetings expecting to understand everything. I'm saying that not only to the ones who come for the first time, but for those who come for 3,000 times already. Because we are trying to talk about ultimate reality, the depths of reality, and the depths of reality are bottomless and endless. So we are advised not to try to approach this unlimited ocean with an intention of capturing and measuring and controlling, but ideally to have some deep experience and deep epiphany that can put us in awe and wonder in front of the mystery of reality. When we try to measure everything, capture everything, understand everything, in our tradition we have a word for that, and that word is called Maya. Actually, Maya means that which can be measured. So we are approaching the infinite with the intention of measuring that amounts to something impossible, basically. That's what we call illusion. So when Kumar invited me to talk about wholeness, I felt very inspired, very happy. That's one of my favorite topics. I personally feel very identified with the need to emphasize wholeness in the context of spiritual life, because many times when we speak or we hear about spiritual practice, many times, not always, but many times, we associate spirituality with holiness, but we forget the wholeness part of the equation. And sometimes an overemphasis on holiness, an overemphasis on transcendence, leave us unwhole, so to say, leave us spiritual bypassing certain needs, certain things that we need to integrate as humans. In my opinion, and it's not only my opinion, but the opinion at least in the tradition I'm trying to embrace, called Gaudiya Vaishnavism, or let's say bhakti, to put it in more simple terms. In the bhakti tradition, which is the tradition of love, humanity and spirituality are not divorced from each other. In fact, the two of them are completely intertwined, ideally. We shouldn't think, according to our vision, we shouldn't think in terms of my spiritual life and my material life. If we choose to see things in those two ways, we choose to create dichotomy and duality. We choose to have a bipolar life, so to say. But ideally, spiritual life is about integration. Integration. Everything can be made part of one same equation. So wholeness has to do with that. Wholeness has to do, to begin with recognizing the wholeness of reality, how everything is whole, complete. The famous verse from the Upanishads in our tradition depicts this, says, Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate. Even if you don't know Sanskrit, you have heard that I repeated the same word many times. Purna, 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 Purna. So Purna in Sanskrit means complete, whole. So this famous statement is declaring how reality is whole. God is whole, complete. And we just need to become aware of the wholeness of everything. The main problem for us is remaining unaware of the wholeness of reality. So wholeness is a very important aspect. And again, it has to do with reclaiming our dignity as human beings and as spiritual souls. We are spiritual souls, but at the same time, we are going through a human experience. We are not so much, as the saying says, we are not so much human beings trying to be spiritual. We are spiritual beings trying to be human, right? We are already spiritual beings, but the human part is not always so much in place. In one way, it's easier for us to be spiritual than it is to be human. Sometimes we may overemphasize spirituality at the cost of humanity, and that results in different forms of these functionalities. In our bhakti tradition, again, humanity and spirituality are expected to go hand by hand, side by side. Our ultimate goal in Sanskrit is called Naralila. Naralila basically means to enter the divine play, the sacred play of the divine. And that play, the nature of that play, is fully human and fully divine. The two of them at the same time. So we are invited to fully spiritualize ourselves without dismissing, without evading our humanity. And as Kumari was mentioning, sometimes talking about our humanity can be even embarrassing for some of us, because humanity, humanness may sound to us like something limited, something vulnerable, something broken, no? Our messiness, our brokenness, our fears, our vulnerabilities. But part of the spiritual journey is going through all that. And also knowing that despite our messiness and brokenness and so on and so forth, one important aspect to understand is God already is loving you fully and accepting you fully for who you are. That's a crucial foundational stepping stone in the Bhakti tradition. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Suhridam Sarvabhutanam, which means I have a good heart for every living entity. I'm a well-wisher friend of every single one of you. And this is an important point that we may never emphasize enough, because many times, as Kumari was saying, many times we may enter into this, what some authors call the trance of unworthiness. It's like a trance that we feel ourselves, I'm unworthy, I'm lovable. And we become so convinced, and then the rest of our life is a desperate attempt to deserve love or to earn love. Well, actually, all the sacred scriptures are telling us, you are already loved, you are already accepted, you already belong. So you don't need to deny who you are or to create a whole character, fictional character, to fit in, because you already belong. We don't need to fit in, we need to belong. And we already belong, we are already accepted and loved by the divine. The point is we may not aware of that. So this is a very important point to create a healthy foundation of, okay, I'm limited, I'm imperfect, and I'm already accepted and loved. That gives hope. The fact that to know that I'm loved empowers me to try to love. You follow? If I feel I'm unlovable, nobody loves me, nobody accepts me, probably I will be terrified about trying to love, because I may feel I'm absolutely unworthy and unlovable. So that freezes me and paralyzes me in trying to express love. But when we know you are already accepted, you are already loved to begin with, that gives us courage to try to show ourselves for who we are, understanding that the very nature of love is unconditional. Love doesn't put conditions like first, you be perfect, first you be this, first you be that, then you will be loved. Imagine if I come to you with a list of terms and conditions, like all the things that you need to fulfill and become perfect in, and then at the end, and only then I will love you. That doesn't sound too loving. On the contrary, that becomes hope. I'm a hopeless, lost case. No? But when we know that despite all messiness, all brokenness, all limitation that still accompany us, we are being fully accepted and loved, that gives us the necessary impetus to dare to love, to dare to reciprocate in kind. So in our tradition, the goal of life is not so much to be loved by God, but to love God in return, because his love is already a given. So I personally feel that's a very important point to create wholeness, to feel I'm already accepted, I'm already loved. Because if not, many times spiritual life just becomes another paranoia, so to say, another neurosis. When I try to perform and I try to be perfect, and in a spiritual life we receive so many high ideals of perfection and purity and transcendence, then if we just feel only until and unless I reach there, I will be loved and accepted, spiritual life can become a very torturous journey. And that's not the idea. So the path of bhakti that we are sharing here, the path of loving devotion, the path of connecting with everything in reality by affection, invites us to, welcomes us fully and invites us to engage all of our faculties in the service of God. In our tradition, there is nothing that is not offerable to God, so to say. Everything has the potential to be connected with the divine. Sambandha, we call that in Sanskrit. Sambandha means everything, sambandha, connected. Everything in reality is connected with the center. God is compared to a center and everything else is constellated around the center and connected with it. So everything is connected with the center already. So when we become aware of that, there is nothing to reject. One of our spiritual teachers, Srila Prabhupada, will say that once a disciple of his told him, for your sake, I'm willing to reject everything. And Srila Prabhupada said, the only thing you need to reject is the idea that you need to reject anything. But we don't need to reject anything. Spiritual practice is not so much about rejecting, but accepting everything from the proper perspective. Accepting everything, understanding how everything is revolving around the common center. That common center is love. Ultimately, love is, they have this popular saying, world makes the world go round or something. We say the same. Vedanta Sutta says, Lokavattu Lila Kaivalyam. The whole material creation, the whole cosmic unfolding is a manifestation, overflowing of God's own heart. That's how the mystics in our tradition explain Srishti Lila, or this divine play of creation. It's like overflowing of God's own heart. So in the Bhakti tradition, we are invited to offer all our functions to the divine. One name of Krishna, one name of God is Hrishikesh, who means this, the master of all senses, of all of mind, body, emotions. All of that can be offered to God. Sarvopadivi nirmuktam tat paratvena nirmalam Hrishikena Hrishikesh Shivanam Bhakti Rujit. The definition of bhakti means you have functions, you have a body, you have mind, you have words, you have thoughts, you have emotions, you have everything, all those faculties can be made a full offering unto the divine. I was telling Kumari that when we were arriving here in the car, I was just wondering maybe what I will talk about. I only had the title and whatever has to come, but we were entering with the car and we saw the sign with the name of the place where we are now, which is Sanctuary, Samarpana Sanctuary. Okay, so I was like, okay, there I have the, that's a hint. Samarpana, that's a beautiful word in Sanskrit. Samarpana Sanctuary. So I immediately thought of one verse that says, Diksha Kali Bhakta Kali Atma Samarpana. The Chaitanya Charitamrita. Samarpana. Samarpana means full offering. Arpana means an offering, something that we offer to someone. Asam means total, complete, full. So this verse is speaking Atma Samarpana. Atma can mean soul, but Atma also can mean body, can mean mind, can mean God even. So Atma Samarpana means all our functions, all our faculties can be integrated into our relationship with God. It's not just about the soul, and we don't need your body, your mind, your emotions, all that has to be discarded. No. All can be integrated. Yukta Vairagya, says Rupa Goswami. Nothing to be rejected, all to be integrated. We don't need to, because sometimes, again, we may understand transcendence as rejection. I've seen that, and I'm not free from that either. I have gone through that a lot. So, and I'm not saying I'm free from that. So transcendence many times is considered as getting rid of, rejecting, and many times that creates a sense of indifference towards what's around us. Srila Rupa Goswami is preventing us in the Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. He says, if you became too much emphasizing renunciation, and I'm a sannyasi, I'm a renounced, so I'm telling that from experience. If you emphasize too much renunciation, your heart will become like a rock. You will start to see everything in terms of renunciation, rejecting, taking distance. And the purpose of the practice is that your heart melts, not that it becomes harder than it is, so to say. So in one sense, we don't need to reject things. We only need to reject the wrong approach to things, the self-centered approach to things. When we think that reality is revolving around us, and our idea of us is a very meager idea. Many times it's a very fractured idea. It's a very still unhealed, unredeemed notion of ourselves. So imagine having such a wounded sense of self and trying to put that in the center of reality and trying to make everything revolve around that. The result is not precisely sweet. So that's why it's important, as Kumari mentioned, and that was the title of today's presentation, how to invite all the aspects of our whole self onto the spiritual path. All the aspects of our whole self are to be invited. Again, it's an invitation to my mind, to my body, to all my functions, to become samarpana, to become a full, complete, beautiful offering to God. God, Krishna, is the full receiver, so he can receive all of our functions, all of our tendencies, all of our, whatever we have to offer, if that comes from a sincere heart, Krishna is taking that. He's called Bhava Grahi Janardana, one name of the divine, which means he's taking the essence of your approach. He's not stuck in formalities. He's not stuck in performance. Spirituality can become very performative many times. So you choose if to address spiritual practice in a performative way or in a transformative way. So it's an important question to ask ourselves on a daily basis. I'm addressing my practice, my connection with the divine and with everything from a performative place or from a transformative place. Performative, again, means I'm performing. I'm creating a public figure or a character, trying to show something that is not, trying to convince the environment that I'm not so bad, that I can be accepted, trying to deserve the affection of people, trying to impress others because, I have a very poor self-image, so I need validation from whole environment. So all those things take us to perform in the name of spirituality. And I can perform very good. I can become a professional spiritual performer, so to say. I can become a superhuman, superhero template performer and doing everything, like waking up earlier than anyone, chanting more than anyone else and studying more and doing everything more and more. But from which place all that's coming? Many times all that's, not always, of course, but many times that can be coming, that super performance can be coming from a deep place of emptiness. When I'm when I feel so empty to myself, when I don't see myself very generously, and when I'm just trying to earn and deserve something by my own merit, instead of becoming humbled by how divine love and unconditional grace comes to my life, even without deserving. And that's transformative. Transformative have to do with contacting the miracle of existence and realizing, well, I'm already loved, I'm already accepted. Our reality is full of awe and wonder. So the practice of bhakti is an invitation, again, to engage all our faculties. Nothing needs to be rejected. We were doing, before the class, we were singing, and the singing sometimes is called sankirtan in Sanskrit, sankirtan, which translates as sometimes collective congregational chanting, collective praise of God. But also sankirtan, the word sam means samyak or complete. And kirtan means praise or celebration. So sankirtan also means a complete celebration. And complete celebration is something that involves all of our faculties, our hearts, our minds, our emotions, our senses, all can be offered into the fire of divine connection. So in bhakti, there is no need to reject our humanity. On the contrary, there is a deep need to embrace our humanity. And part of embracing our humanity means embracing our vulnerability. Vulnerability is not a bad word. Some of us may misconstrue vulnerability with being weakness. Being vulnerable means being weakness, being weak. So I want to be strong. So that translates as I won't be vulnerable. I will show myself as strong always, which is not true. We are not always strong. We are vulnerable by nature. But many times we are not being educated that it's okay to be vulnerable. Actually, it's necessary. Actually, you cannot not be vulnerable. Your nature is to be vulnerable. You are finite. And you are confronting the infinite. You are vulnerable. And it's okay. No problem. If we are able to express our vulnerability in a safe space, the result of that is empowerment. We are able to open our hearts to show ourselves for who we are in front of the proper people. That's empowering. Srila Rupa Goswami is mandating, one of our teachers is instructing the importance. One of the main ways to interact affection, exchange affection, sat vidam priti lakshanam, he says, guhyama kyati prichati, means open your heart to other people that you connect with and receive the heart of other people. He will say, reveal your mind in confidence. Be vulnerable. Allow to show yourself as transparently as you can in front of people that you trust, and learn to honor and receive the trust of other people who are showing up in a transparent, equally transparent way. That's a deep expression of affection for one another. Deep expression of affection. So, as I said before, bhakti is meant to be fully human. Bhakti is meant to be fully divine. Bhakti is meant to be a practice where we are invited to be vulnerable in such a way that we can be empowered, in such a way that we can be seen for who we are without fear, without a need of putting masks in between. In Sanskrit, we have this term, darshan. You may have heard the word darshan. And darshan doesn't mean so much to see, but darshan means in Sanskrit to be seen. So darshan is allow yourself to be seen. Many times we don't want to be seen. We are hiding ourselves, escaping, or trying again to show facades or masks. Because we fear that if I actually am seen, if they really know who I am, they see my weakness, my fear, they will reject me. I will be alone. I won't be loved. That's our deepest fear. And that's very important to understand. Real love and real belonging will never reject us for who we are. But of course, we need to get in contact with those people. We need to get in contact with persons who are able to represent unconditional love in our lives, who are accepting us for who we are, without judgments, without bias, without assumptions, and are inviting us to express our fullest potential. A real sage, a real wise person is someone who is not judging us for who we are, is not judging us for who we were, not for what we did in the past, nor what we are in the present, but a sage person is seeing us for all that we can be in the future. That's real generosity. That's how God is looking upon us. Not so much, oh, you did this 20 years ago, I know who you are. Yeah, you did this. Many times we treat each other like that. No? That person, I know him. He did 25 years ago, he did this. So we put them in a box. There's no chance for improvement and change and transformation. That's not very merciful. Or sometimes we are a little more merciful. We judge each other for who we are in the present. But still, that's not fully gracious, because we should relate to each other according to our potential, our brightest potential. Even if I'm a mess today, and I am personally, I need the hope that someone is seeing in me some bright potential that can be extracted from that present mess. And let's work on that. That's what in our tradition we call the guru. Guru is someone who sees our potential, not only sees our potential, but embodies our potential. Spiritual teachers, in the words of one of my teachers, a guru is your own potential appearing in front of you. Try to imagine that. Try to imagine all that you can be, which we cannot imagine, suddenly appearing in front of you, embodied in a person who shows you this is all that you can be and more. And here I am to help you to attain that beautiful potential. So that's how we are supposed to treat each other, basically. In a generous way, seeing the potential that accompanies us. And again, this generosity has to be directed in every direction. It's not just how we treat each other as practitioners, how we relate with God, or how we relate with some intimate people, but ideally, if we want to love the divine, if we want to establish a deep connection with the center of reality, that has to be reflected in how we relate with everything else. If I say I love God, but I'm mistreating other people, that shows how much I love God, actually. Because everything is connected with God. So if I mistreat someone, that's ultimately applicable to the center, to God himself. It is described in the Bhagavad Gita, Yomam Pashyati Sarvatra, Sarvam Chamai Pashyati. Krishna says, for one who sees everything in me and sees me in everything, I'm never lost to him, he's never lost to me. So the symptom of an advanced soul is that person is seeing the divine presence everywhere, in everyone, in everything. So they will relate to that accordingly. They will honor every person, every situation. So again, there's no need to reject anything or anyone. Not even this world, that sometimes, unfortunately, in different traditions, including mine, sometimes we have become too otherworldly to the point that we end up rejecting the material energy. But material energy is an energy, a divine energy, a sacred energy that our teachers will say they are. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, Maya Shakti is the highest Vaishnavi. Sanatan Goswami says the same, Briha Bhagavatam Brita. Material energy is the highest devotee of God. So if you dismiss, reject material energies, akin to Vaishnavi Aparat. We don't want to do that. So part of our wholeness project is to make peace with the world of matter. We don't need to reject, we just need to properly connect with it. We just need to reject the wrong approach to things. Nothing else needs to be rejected. For example, in the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is our main book, it's very interesting how the Srimad Bhagavatam begins. Because the main character of the Srimad Bhagavatam, so to say, Parikshit Maharaj, is asking his Guru Sukadeva Goswami a series of questions. And the first answer to those questions is Sukadeva Goswami's description of the Virat Rupa, which basically means learn to see the world as the body of God. In a figurative sense, but nonetheless, it's an important point. It all begins by being properly settled and grounded in this world. There are further heights to attain, transcendence, but first, learn to relate with the world of matter in a healthy, realistic way. Learn to see the world as divine, basically. That's the main, the first lesson of the Bhagavatam, so to say. Learn to connect with this world as a divine manifestation. The more you can do that, the more we can talk deeper about other realities, more subtle, more esoteric, deeper and deeper. But in one sense, we don't need to reject this world. We don't need to reject anything again. We don't need to change our landscape as a friend of mine says, we just need to change our eyes. We don't need to reach a new landscape. We need to go to the same landscape with new eyes. He will give this example of, it took me some time for me to understand because it's a North American example of a sport that is not so popular in my country, in Argentina, which is baseball. So he started to talk technically about baseball, and I was like, we play soccer over there, sorry. So he was talking about how in baseball you start at home, right? And you run through the different bases, but the goal is to return home. To return home, but now having gone through other, having done this journey. Now, he compared that to Joseph Campbell's Hero's Journey. Now, this is a very famous template that is, you are at home, you stay at the familiar, in your comfort zone, and then you leave the comfort zone. You leave the familiar, and you go to the unknown, and you become initiated in the mysteries of reality, and eventually you return home, transformed. So the point is, you don't need to, it's not about rejecting home, rejecting where you are, but just going through the particular transformation that makes you return home with new eyes. So no need to change the landscape, just need to change the vision. That's why we praise the guru saying, Om Agyanati Mirandasya Agyanam Janashalak Chakshur Militam Yen Tashmi Sri Gurubhya. To say that the guru is applying a particular salve and a particular eye surgery internally, not externally, to give us new eyes, to give us new vision of the same things, quote unquote, that we have in front of us. According to our tradition, for example, in every single atom, God is present. Brahma Samhita says that every atom hosts God fully. So try to imagine that. How much we can see this world as profane. Every atom is an embassy of God's presence. So when we start to acquire this type of orientation to life, everything is sacred, basically. Everything is divine. There's no need to reject anything. There's only a need to celebrate the sacredness of existence. Presence of God everywhere, and the chance to engage all our faculties in connection to the divine. That's why Krishna in the Gita says, Raja Vidya Raja Guhim Pavitram Idam Uttamam Pratyaksha Bhagavam Dharmyam Sushukam Kartam Abhyayam. He says that bhakti is the king of all knowledge and the king of all secrets, and it's understood by pratyaksha, which means by personal experience, sense experience. So we are not rejecting here your personal experience. It has just to be expressed in a proper way. And the practice, the spiritual practice, susukam kartum, is to be engaged with full joy, in a full spirit of celebration. There are lots of reasons to celebrate existence. If we don't think that's the case, then we may need just to adjust our angle of vision. When distraction becomes the norm instead of the exception to the norm, that's when we stop seeing the marvel of reality. But bhakti, again, this process of devotion, of connecting with reality through love, wants us complete, again, wants us holy, but wants us whole as well, wants our humanity full in place. No? We don't want what sometimes is called a disembodied spirituality. No? We want a fully connected spirituality with all our functions. The power of bhakti, the power of divine love, is that it can, how to say, penetrate every pore of our being, spiritualize every pore of our being. Again, diksha kali bhakta kari atma samarpana. The meaning of being initiated in this tradition is you can make of your whole being and samarpana. Remember, that's the name where we are here now, samarpana, sanctuary. A full offering, a complete offering of each one of our functions for Hrishikesh. Hrishikena Hrishikesh Sivanam Bhakti Ruchati. God is Hrishikesh. He can receive our senses, our minds, our emotions, our body. As long as the heart is in the right place, he's receiving what we have to give him. Even if it's a flower externally, as we say, if it's a leaf, patram pushpam phalam tuyam, Krishna Gita say, you can offer me flower, fruit, water, leaf, anything. But Jomi Bhakya Paryachati Tadaham Bhakti Pahitam Krishnami Prayatatmana. He uses two times the word bhakti. He says flower, fruit, water, anything. But bhakti, bhakti. He says twice, give me your heart, give me your heart. Love, love. So if my heart is in the right place, everything else is secondary. So Jai, welcome. Anyhow, some words I want to share with you today by invitation of Rupam Kumari on the topic of wholeness and the importance of becoming balanced human beings in the spiritual project. One thing doesn't exclude the other. We call that in Sanskrit sattva. Sattva means to become a balanced person. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, yuktahara viharasya yuktah chistasya karma, and so on. He said, everything you do has to be balanced. Your eating has to be balanced. Your resting has to be balanced. Your recreation has to be balanced. In other words, you are supposed to be balanced. You are supposed to have your humanity in place. Because many times we can become obsessed with spiritual holiness, but still remain humanly dysfunctional. I've seen that a few times. That's not very tasty. Or we can again embrace spirituality as an evasive method not to deal with that unresolved human issue. Sometimes many of us carry unresolved childhood trauma, for example. And many of us may go to spiritual life with good intention, but unconsciously avoiding that unresolved stuff. And many times our unresolved emotional stuff gets in the way of our practice or gets mixed with our practice, and we are not able to realize what's going on. So that's why one of our teachers, who is God himself appearing as a teacher, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in his only written legacy, in the first verse, in the first line, the first three words, he says, Chitta Darpana Marjana. Chitta Darpana Marjana. Chitta means chitta. Chitta means the subconscious mind. Darpana Marjana means clean the mirror of your subconscious mind. So it's interesting. He's mentioning the importance of confronting our unconscious, trying to deal with those things that may be in the unconscious, and we need them to be brought to the plane of consciousness. So spiritual life, again, is an integration of complexity. We don't want meditation, yoga, prayer, offerings to be any form of evasiveness. We want all to take us to proper confrontation of reality, in the good sense of the term confrontation. That's not a bad word. To confront something is to put something in front of me, something that maybe was behind me and I was not seeing it, but it's affecting me, to bring it to consciousness so I can relate to that from a proper place. So Chaita Darpana Marjanam. The first effect of the chanting of the holy names is some things that are in my subconscious may come to my conscious platform. And I need to do something with that. And sometimes that's not easy. As you can see, I'm never using the word easy here. I also never use the word impossible. That something is difficult doesn't mean that it's impossible. Sometimes the problem is that we make what we feel difficult, sometimes we translate that as impossible. And that becomes discouraging. But the opposite of easy is not difficult. The opposite of easy is impossible. Difficult is just the middle point between easy and impossible. So we need to be properly guided and properly educated and properly assisted so we can deal with all this inner landscape that sometimes lies in certain darkness of our inner world. And the practice of bhakti is cleaning the heart, and the more we clean our heart, the more certain things start to become more apparent. But then we need to do something with that. So bhakti is also for courageous people. It's a courageous journey in which we want to see reality as it is. The soul in itself, who we are as souls, is totally brilliant and totally incredible. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, verse 29, Ascharyabhat, Ascharyabhat, Ascharyabhat. He says the soul is wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. So we don't need to worry about who we are in our constitution. Krishna is saying, you are wonderful. The soul is wonderful. Three times he says that. Generally, nobody says that to us three times per day. You're wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Most of us, when my wife will tell me that one day, when my husband will tell me one time, wonderful, once a year. Krishna is telling that thrice every single moment of his life. The soul is wonderful. You are wonderful. Not to become proud, because we are not our own creation. So it's not like, okay, I'm wonderful, okay, I'm wonderful. But you are not your own creation. Who you happen to be as a soul is wonderful. The potential of love for the soul is wonderful. So that's humbling when we realize that. So knowing that, we can work with all the, what we call anarthas, with all the false values, with all the misidentification, with all the things we think we are, but we are not. That need to be put in their place, so to say. By keeping in mind, who I am as a soul, who I am as consciousness, it's wonderful. Again, it's not my own creation, but I cannot deny its wonderfulness. Krishna himself is confirming that. Krishna is giving that verse the recipe for self-love and self-esteem. There is place for self-esteem in bhakti. You can love the Atma. You can love yourself, not in a selfish, narcissistic way, but just the soul is wonderful. And I'm humbled by that, and I will just dedicate my life to explore the depths of that wonder. Wonder is a very important aspect of our practice. In Sanskrit, wonder also sometimes is called chamatkar. Rasasar chamatkar, says Kavi Karnapur. The highest peak of love, the essence of that is astonishment, awe and wonder. Also, the beginning of our practice has to be fueled by awe and wonder. Many times in our tradition, we will speak about surrender. And sometimes that word can be a little weaponized. It's a beautiful word, but it can be a dangerous one. I'll tell you, just surrender there, surrender, and it becomes more like an artificial imposition, like it sounds more like a totalitarian regime. Surrender there, and I don't give many explanations, and we may do it out of fear, out of coercion, out of social pressure, while actually surrender has to be fueled by awe and wonder. When I feel awe and wonder, I naturally surrender to that. I naturally give myself. So that's irresistible. So when we naturally contact the wonderful essence of the soul, the wonderful essence of God, the wonder of everything, we naturally feel invited to give ourselves fully. So anyhow, this is the invitation of bhakti. And this is the path we are trying to thread. It's an endless path. It's a beautiful path. We should be very careful not to take bhakti for granted. We should be very careful not to think that we already know what bhakti is about, what love is about. We are just touching one point of an infinite line. That's it. And we should remain always like eternal students, willing to learn, willing to grow, as God himself is an eternal student of love. Krishna himself says in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Radhikar Prima Guru Amish Shishya Nata. The love of Sri Radha is my guru, and I am a student in her dancing school. I'm a puppet in her hands. So in our tradition, God himself is a student in the school of love, to put it poetically. That's our God, the humble God. And we want a God who is humble, humbles himself in front of love, Because love is the goal of life, basically. Love is the goal of life for us. Love is the goal of life even for God. God has love, but he can always have more love. The nature of love is ever expanding. So love remains a constant goal to attain because it's a constant movement and depth and growth. So anyhow, some thoughts we want to share today about bhakti, about the path of devotion, and about how embracing bhakti implies an invitation to all our faculties and to the whole self to be presented in the spiritual path. So if you have any questions, any thoughts, something you may like to share in this connection or in any other connection, we have 10 minutes for that as well. And while someone here online, I'm doing a streaming, that's why I have my computer. Terry here is saying, I need to repeatedly hear this message of love, ability. Okay, I need to hear repeatedly as well. So that's why I'm repeating it myself. First of all, for me. Kumar, yes.
I apologize if this is redundant, but because I might not have heard everything you said. But I guess my question is, so I know that I'm lovable, but due to some conditioning, I have these parts of me which I feel ashamed of, or I feel are unlovable or unworthy. And when I approach my practice of bhakti, let's say I approach my sadhana, I go to sit down and I start to chant, or then these parts of me are always coming up. And I become more aware of those parts of me rather than the actual practice. And I'm just thinking of how I'm unworthy. So in that moment, how can I bring love, or how can I remember that those parts of me have love? What can I do in that moment?
Okay. I'll repeat briefly so those who are here may listen, but thank you so much. Whether it was a personal testimony or you were talking in first person in a more general way.
It's very much a real thing for me.
Yeah, of course. Welcome to the club. You are not alone in that. So I appreciate your bravery and vulnerability in being willing to say something like that, because sometimes these things all of us may be experiencing, but until and unless someone is courageous enough to voice them, nobody's saying anything. Everyone's like, and when someone says that, it's like, oh, I also have that. Oh, and you feel the impetus to enter into the arena as well. So thank you for inviting us to be more human and more sincere and more vulnerable, more realistic. So Kumari was asking that during practice, many times we may feel unlovable and unworthy. And sometimes during our practice, whether we are chanting or praying or meditating, these ideas may come and get in the way of our practice, and we may end up being more aware of that than of what we are supposed to be aware of. So what to do? So Kumar is asking some magical formula to solve all her problems immediately. Well, sorry, that's not possible. That's not so easy, but... We'll try to say something, of course. So, yeah, first of all, I think it's important, first of all, to accept that those things are happening. There are sequential steps to solve that. Of course, the first step is that's going on, because some people may not be willing to see that, may not be willing to recognize, I feel myself unlovable, unworthy, I feel shame, I feel guilt. So they may not be willing even to see that. Other people may see that, but may not be willing to articulate that and put that out of their mouths, what to speak of doing that in a public circle. So all that in itself is big progress, no? I'm saying that just so we can also like value that and get some hope. Okay, we are moving forward. Now that's safe, and we may have heard, okay, Krishna loves you unconditionally. But to be honest, generally speaking, and I put myself and include myself in the list, most of us need to hear that so many times. And it's not just about hearing that, not like a mechanical thing. Okay, I will record that, put play, but try to enter into that space. No, like to, you are developed of God. You are developed of Krishna. Try to, that's your identity. No? So we have to find creative ways to repeat that in ways that are relatable to us so we can really become convinced that that's a fact. No? Like I like to say, when we ask ourselves who we are, or you ask some other person, who are you? Many of us reply to that saying what we do many times. Who are you? I'm a lawyer. What we do? Now we identify ourselves as human doings instead of human beings. I am what I do. For other people, who are you? And you reply, what you have, human havings. Or sometimes who you are, and you say what other people think about you. That's me, public opinion, vox populi. Or sometimes, who are you? Who I am, who I think I am. Which still, sometimes that's the worst possible answer. Because we don't think of us very nicely many times. And many times we tell things to ourselves that we will never tell anyone else. But to ourselves, green light, everything goes. So who we are who we are in the eyes of God. That's our ultimate identity. We are how God is looking upon us. That's our real self. And Krishna, God is looking upon us through the eyes of unconditional love. So unworthiness is it, for me, I will say unworthiness or self-loathing, guilt, these are the worst anarthas, so to say. Way above things like lust and greed and arrogance. All that for me are just like cover-ups from these more subtle things. Because for example, someone tells me, I don't know, Maharaj, I disagree with you. For me, arrogance is the worst thing, to give an example. Arrogance is the worst, not self-guilt. But if you understand what's arrogance, arrogance is basically you try to put yourself on a pedestal and to see yourself or make others see you as super special, so you don't have to realize how badly you see yourself and treat yourself. That's the actual background of arrogance. Like I was talking the other day with a friend, devotee friend, and he told me that Maharaj, and I appreciate his honesty. He told me, I really want to be famous. I want lots of fame, lots of recognition. And he told me, I know that's not right, but I want that. What to do? And he said, okay, that's a problem. I was like, that's not a problem. That's a symptom of the real problem. I think the real problem, and I don't know him that much, but somehow felt, okay, let's throw my theory out there and hopefully it's accurate, I told him. I said, I think that, again, you want to be very famous because you need to create a character that is seen and recognized in a certain way to counteract how poorly you see yourself. And probably that's related to certain aspect of your relationship with your mother, I told him. It came like that. And he was like, yeah, you're right. That's the problem. And I didn't know him that much, but it came that way. So I'm happy that was accurate. But my point is, this is many times at the very root of most of our problems. So my point is, it's a quite a formidable, I don't want to call it enemy, but thing that we need to solve. So for us also to understand, it may take some time, you know, not to get discouraged that, oh, after 2 weekends of repeating myself that I'm the beloved of God, still this unworthiness stuff is there. Yeah, probably will stay there for some time because in many cases it's rooted. And again, I don't know most of you in detail, but many times it's rooted in a situation from our childhood or sometimes even from previous lives, who knows, where we feel we have not been treated in a way that we are fully lovable and worthy. And the message we received was, you will be accepted only when you deserve it. So, and that's the message in this modern society, basically. Unless you are perfect, you are not accepted. You are not part. Mm. So we are receiving that mantra, so to say, from every direction. You have to perform. If you are not perfect, at least fake it. Fake perfection. Show as if you are perfect. At least that. As they say, you have the saying, fake it till you make it. And I remember when I wrote my second book, Radical Personalism, I felt, no, better let's put it this way. Naked till you make it. Naked in terms of be vulnerable. That's the only way you will be able to make it, not fake it till you make it. But that narrative is so underlying every other narrative. Unless you are perfect, you don't belong. Unless you perform well, you are not accepted, and so on. That it's so easy to feel, I cannot do it. I'm not enough. I'm never enough. It's never enough. And that's exhausting. And if you come with that template to spiritual life, hopefully that's relieved. But if not, it can become maximized even. If it's not properly dealt with, it's like, this is the topmost goal and you are completely fallen and completely unworthy and completely blah, 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 blah. And that's not the idea. So I will say, I mean, it's very important that that our circle, of our intimate circle, is people who really accept us for who we are and who can really give us unconditional love and acceptance. So I would say that's the most powerful antidote to counteract our own sense of unworthiness. Now, to be surrounded by people that make it very clear that I love you as you are now. And you will say, but I'm a mess. Yeah, I know that. But I love you. This doesn't have to do whether you are a mess or not. We know you're a mess because we know everyone is a mess. So the thing here is not whether I'm a mess or not. That's already solved. You are a mess. The important thing is whether we are loved or not, and that's already solved. Everyone is already loved unconditionally by God. And I know that for some people it's okay. It sounds nice, but it sounds too abstract for me. God loves me unconditionally. I'm not feeling it. Or maybe if you had a very hard life, you may think, I don't believe that God loves me unconditionally. So then, if someone feels that, then you are called to represent that unconditional love in the life of that person. If that person cannot believe that there is a God who is made of unconditional love, then if you have had an experience of that love, you can transmit that to that person, accepting them unconditionally. So it may take time, but that's part of the exercise of disciplining our mind. When the mind goes to that dark place of unworthiness, you are crap, you don't have any value, you are unworthy, you will never make it, you are never enough. All these like absolutely brutally cruel statements, we need to bring the mind back to reality, which is, I'm not any of those things. The Atma, the soul, as Krishna says in the Gita, Acharya. The Atma is wonderful. In Sanskrit, Acharya means many things. I did some research on Acharya means miracle, wonderful, shocking. So you are shockingly, the soul is shockingly wonderful. It's too much. That's who we are by grace of Krishna. So we need to bring the mind back to those facts. Who I actually are. If it helps you, you can have some affirmations written. I mean, whatever works better for each one's situation and nature, but to bring the mind back to reality, you can have a compilation of verses. I can provide them if that helps. Where Krishna says in the scripture very clearly, I love every living entity unconditionally. You are loved unconditionally. You don't need to deserve. You don't need to earned love. If love is earned, that's not love. If love is conditional, that's not love. If I tell you I only love you when you are perfect, that's not love. Love is perfect in the sense that love, real perfection does not exclude imperfection. Real perfection includes imperfection. That's real perfection. something that is perfect includes imperfection, embraces imperfection, and redeems it. So that's love. Love is perfect because love can include imperfection. And from that place, enlighten us. But yeah, I will say to be close to people who constantly give us affection and love unconditionally and remind us of how lovable we already are. That's the medicine we need to take on a daily basis. And if some days we are receiving some particular cloudy day of unworthiness, yeah, we may need just to take practical measurements. You can just run to that person, to those people, and please remind me about who I actually am, because I'm going on a nightmare now. It's okay, it's part of the journey. No? We know those things will happen, and we are here to support each other, to accompany each other. I hope that helps in some level. I know there's no one button to press and it's gone. We need to go through that beautiful struggle, battle to reclaim our belovedness, so to say, right? Yeah. But I think when we are really properly situated in this fact of, okay, Krishna loves me unconditionally, that sets the ground for the ideal spirit to reciprocate in kind. Because if not, many times we are engaging in bhakti from a place of fear, guilt, unworthiness. Okay, I will practice bhakti because so Krishna is not angry with me. I will love Krishna so he loves me back someday. And that's very distorted. Krishna already loves you, and you engage in bhakti to give back the embrace, basically. Again, the goal of our life is not love from, the goal of bhakti is not love from God. The goal of bhakti is love for God. Because his love is already coming. And it's not easy, as you mentioned. It may sound to some like even New Agey to say, you are loved by Krishna. Just enter into that spirit. I'm loved by God. So, Maharaj, why are you making it so easy? So easy, try to do it. Try to enter a space where you are already loved. And you will see how much resistance is there. How hard that is. How we try to convince ourselves that that cannot be true. And even if Krishna manifests in front of you and says, I love you, we will have such a long list of reasons why he shouldn't love us. I will try to enter a debate and convince him, you shouldn't love me because I'm this, I'm horrible, I'm a mess. And he's like, I love you. That's unconditional love. So at the end of the day, we have to accept defeat, so to say, and put down all our mechanisms and realize, okay, it's okay. I can be loved. I can accept that. No? It's humbling. Properly understood, that's absolutely humbling. And many times that's why we may resist even unconsciously to that, because it's too humbling to know that you're absolutely loved, probably without having done anything to deserve that. That's quite humbling. So that sometimes may be bitter pill to swallow. It may take time, but it's so important. Some other question or comment, something you may like to ask me to share? Yes. What's your name? Sorry?
My name is Anjali.
Anjali? Yes. Thank you.
I'm.
Oh. Yes, yeah.
I'm very curious. You were talking about how sometimes when we look at the world from a self-centered perspective and we see things from a self-centered way, then that can distort from what we're really supposed to be experiencing, which is the perspective of all. But sometimes it feels like being when you're self-centered or when you're looking at something, it's so easy to fall into like the self-centered idea, almost like it's a low gravity, like you're falling back into a pattern and continue to go back into it.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a practice that you would recommend, or a way of thinking that you would recommend to help stop or separate yourself from that pattern of just falling back in and being selfish in something?
Yeah, thank you. I'll repeat briefly. So Anjali is asking here, we were talking about self-centeredness and the problems of self-centeredness and seeing reality as if everything is revolving around us. So Anjali is asking if there is some practice or some recommendation for us to not fall into that default mode, so to say, which sometimes it's the usual way. And I know it's, again, I'm not here to give any magical formula in the way of just do this and in 5 minutes you are beyond that. A big part of the answer is acknowledging the degree to which we are affected by that. Not to become hopeless, but just to also not take the whole matter lightly, like, okay, in a weekend I'm beyond self-centeredness. So that may take some time. So in our tradition, we'll recommend a group of practices, so to say, called satsanga, called swadhyaya, called kirtan, all of these, which basically entail, one of them is like participating in meetings like this, in terms like hearing about these themes repeatedly, no? Because now we are talking about that and you're hearing about that and we become aware of, oh yeah, self-centeredness. But then we start to forget what we were hearing, so we need to hear it again and again and again. As we hear narratives about self-centeredness so many times, to the point that we became convinced by them, we need to counteract that by incorporating some other type of counter-narrative, so to say, that starts to insist on, with all affection, but you are not the center of reality. You have a place in reality, but you are not the center. And that's a big relief, no? So joyful that I'm not the center. That's with such a huge responsibility that I can't, it's too much for me, right? I'm revolving around reality. So for us, for example, studying sacred texts would educate our perspective is crucial in that connection. It's a daily food for our mind. No? On a daily basis, we always incorporate knowledge and information, and that informs our movements of life. It informs our actions, and those actions bear the fruits. We call these three things sambandha, videya, and prayojan. So sambandha means the knowledge that orients our life. Then avideya is how we live our life, and prayojan is the fruit of living our life in that way. So if the sambandha or the knowledge that orients my life is predominated by a self-centered notion, we need to gradually dismantle that and re-establish a proper knowledge that orients our life for who we are, not being the center. So we recommend, yeah, contacting sacred texts, scriptures, mass teachers who give presentations on these topics, and try to make that part of our daily life and practice, as much as one wants and can, of course. But as we dedicate time to it, we can also get nourished by receiving spiritual advice, proper guidance. And the practice we were doing also before, the chanting that we were doing all together, sometimes can be performed individually. The actual spirit of that chanting is trying to connect with the center, with God, with the divine, or where we may like to call him, her, they, Radha and Krishna, plural, feminine, masculine. We have all the options in the market, no problem. So the chanting of this mantra is also a way of reestablishing the center in our lives and realizing I am in service of that center. I want to give myself in love to that center who is made of love, who is already loving me unconditionally. So this chanting that we were doing is a way of reminding ourselves and establishing ourselves in that situation, in that position. I'm a servant of the center. I'm not the center. I want to love the center. So all this combined, no? Studying of sacred texts, listening from teachers, gatherings like this, where we share each other, where we remind each other about these facts, meditation, prayer, chanting, all put together, and of course try to be embraced on a daily basis as much as we can, in time creates a transformation in consciousness, creates a transformation in our vision of things. We may still in time fall into self-centeredness, but in time the falling into that becomes less and less usual. And even when it happens, we can anticipate that, we can detect that more quickly. When our mind is not trained for that, we may be in self-centeredness and not even realize we are there for time immemorial, so to say. So, yeah, some of those practices will be important. To expose ourselves to knowledge about the center basically helps us to realize who is the center and what's our role in connection to it. And again, it's a center made of unconditional love. So it's not a tyrant, it's not a dictator, it's not a boss that we need to be afraid. Oh, that's the center. I don't want to give myself to it. No, it's a sweet, all attractive, all merciful, sacred center, so to say. So it's a joy to be in service of that center. Yeah. Thank you for your question. I hope that helps. Okay. There's something else before closing the curtain. Maharaji, please.
It's also that the just on the point of self-centered. Lord Brahma, he says that the first law of nature is self-preservation. So it's almost inherent in the soul to be self-centered, almost in my best interest. And our Acharya Srila Prabhupada, if you really want to be self-interested, you'll serve Krishna. Because Krishna is the Supreme Self, and we're part and parcel of the Supreme. So the inherent and natural tendency of the soul is to move towards Krishna. So in one sense, to be selfish is pure. It's like we don't reject anything. Okay, selfish means that the soul connects with the Supreme Soul and lives in bliss and harmony. So we don't reject, you know, we have a condition, but now we put ourselves, our own happiness first in the material world, and then when we come to God consciousness, we put the happiness of Krishna first, serve Krishna. And then really, like Srila Prabhupada would say, someone who loves Krishna will love an ant. Yeah, because if we put our love, now our love is like divided. We love a dog, love a cat, love the kid, love the wife, love grandma, auntie. Our love is divided. But for a devotee, he puts his love only to Krishna. And then when that love goes just to Krishna, the center, then there's, it comes back, overflows, and there's love for everyone, because the devotee sees Krishna everywhere. So then he can love everybody. So then where's the question of being selfish? Because now is I'm entering the world of love, and I'm just loving everybody. Why? Because the devotee sees Krishna everywhere. So this is real selfishness, is to love God, and then you'll love everybody. And that's solution.
Thank you. Thank you. Important point. Yeah. Loving God doesn't exclude loving everyone else. It's like the Bhagavatam say, rooting, putting water in the root naturally goes to every other direction. So we are not, by loving God, we are not excluding anyone. But
we're loving everyone.
We're loving everyone. Everything falls into the equation.
In connection to Krishna.
Yeah.
Not separate. Nothing separate from God.
Yeah. Something else? Any other question, comments, contribution to the circle? Okay. So well, yes.
When we work to not see ourselves as separate, that includes seeing ourselves as part of the Leela.
Okay, thanks for the question. So we have to strive again. The illusion, what we call illusion, is the illusion of separatedness, right? To see ourselves as isolated units, separated from the center, no? The Srimad Bhagavatam begins saying, Advaigyan Tattva. Reality is non-dual consciousness. In other words, the ultimate realities, there are not two ultimate realities, two, three, four. There's one, the ultimate reality, and everything exists in connection to it. Nothing exists inseparable from God. in an ontological way, we can speak in terms of Shakti Mam and Shakti. Sorry if I'm becoming too technical here. In Sanskrit, Shakti Mam is the source of all energies, God, and there is Shakti, the different energies or potencies. We are one potency, the world is another potency, love is another potency. But all exist interrelated. There are no fragmented, isolated units. Now, in connection to your question, in the Lila, if the fact that we are not separated from God means that we are not separated from the Lila, or that we are already in the Lila, that's not specifically the case yet. But one thing doesn't exclude, we are connected with God in the sense that God is the source of everyone and nothing exists separated from Him. But our active participation in Lila, Lila is a Sanskrit term that means play, or the divine loving interaction in eternal relationship with God. That is something, I will say, that's the fruit. When we become aware of our connection with the divine, the more our awareness, what we call Krishna consciousness, the more we become conscious of our Krishna consciousness, so to say, the more eventually we will realize which is our role and position of service in the Lila. But it's not something that is, how to say, already happening, that we are with Krishna in the Lila, but we are unaware of that, or we are sleeping to that or something. Sometimes I know practitioners that may posit arguments like that, but in my opinion, that's not sustainable by what the scriptures are telling. So yeah, we are connected with the center, with the source. And the more we become aware of that connection and play out that connection and live out that connection gradually, the ultimate expression of that will be we entering, if you want to put it that way, the world of Lila. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you so much to all of you for your time, for your presence, for your company. So we'll do some short kirtan, a few minutes. Meanwhile, I assume prasadam will be served and we will continue sharing more informally. So we'll try to now take from a little bit more theoretical sharing and presentation. Let's go now to a more practical realm and sharing again. We'll sing together and we'll try to enter into this spirit of acknowledging the center and ourselves in connection to it, in connection to the principle of divine love.